Hello and welcome to the January Review Show on Crime Time FM. I'm Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. The show's a little earlier than usual this month, but the quiet Christmas break did wonders for my uninterrupted reading, so I've a batch of books for you to kick off 2024 in style. So first up is Mary Hanna's latest DCI Kate Daniels thriller, The Longest Goodbye. 3 years on, and Kate is still reeling from the loss of her friend and colleague, Georgina. She was killed during an operation that went tragically wrong. The killers were never caught. A sense of injustice and unfinished business haunts Kate and her team. The likely suspects are Jackson and Jacob Bradshaw. They've been hiding out in Spain, but they've been lured back to the UK. They barely touch soil when they're killed in an ambush. As they were the prime suspects in Georgina's murder, the inevitable question of whether someone in the police took revenge emerges. There are other suspects, of course, gangsters in Spain, other players from the past. But more than anything, opening this new investigation is the second chance for Kate to solve Georgina's murder. There are plenty of twists as Kate's team and a possible vigilante are under scrutiny. Kate puts her career on the line and the team are in danger. There's a fascinating moral conundrum at the heart of this novel, and few British writers are producing police procedurals of the quality of Hanna. Her compassion for characters, both sides of the law, stands out, and Kate Daniels is certainly a brilliant creation. Somewhere between the person we'd like to be, a determination, loyalty, moral strength, and who we are in practice, which is flawed, of course, impetuous and capable of bending the rules too. The ninth Kate Daniels is certainly a welcome addition to a fine series, published by Orion in paperback. James Henry's The Winter Visitor is also a police procedural, but this time set in Essex in 1991, and it's evocative of the gangsters of that time who were making newspaper headlines, often for winding up dead, or being portrayed in low-budget Brit noir gangster flicks. Bruce Hopkins is another returnee from Spain, from the Costa del Sol Crookhaven to Colchester. He just about has time to visit a couple of people, including his ex-wife Chloe, before getting abducted at gunpoint, stripped, thrown into the boot of a car, and dumped in the river. The case of the dead dope dealer falls to the oddball pairing of DS's Kenton and Brazier. They're also looking into a series of arson attacks, including a Norman church, and the suicide of a local florist. Each of the strands of the story is intriguing, and naturally, and skillfully, they come together very nicely at the end. This is a grim reimagining of the Essex underbelly of 30 years ago, and it feels authentic. The whys and wherefores take us down some interesting avenues. Who is settling old scores, and why now? This is a highly readable novel, with an entertaining storyline and intriguing characters. Published in hardback by River Run. Halfway around the world now for a dark slice of rural stroke outback noir. From one of Australia's top crime writers, Chris Hammer. Cover the Bones. This is the fifth in the series, and even though I know the territory that Hammer is working in, I'm still impressed every time by how good each new story is. Some of you may have seen the recent adaptation of the first novel on streaming, Scrublands. If not, catch it if you can, because it's pretty good. But it doesn't, for obvious reasons, have the depth of Hammer's debut, which features journalist Martin Scarsdon. That said, it does get the essentials well. So on to the latest epic, Cover the Bones. In the fictional town of Yawandari, a little oasis on the border of the outback in New South Wales, the body of a man turns up in an irrigation channel on the state MP's land. Atul Hasluck is a member of one of the seven dynasties that founded and ran the town. And he won't be the last of the local landowners to go. Things will escalate, unless the killer is caught. Detectives Ivan Lukic and Neil Buchanan investigate, and they're brilliant characters in the novel, and is soon embroiled as secrets going back as far as the First World War in the now. And then down the line, Martin Scarsdon of the Herald turns up to cover the story. As ever, Hammer paints a brilliant portrait of rural life, and its links to the city and big town politics. Corruption, rivalry, revenge, land ownership, race, it's all there. An uncomfortable portrait of modern Australia, warts and all. It's a mystery that really grips. The characters speak to time and place. A powerful social critique that has the possibility to move. It's a poignant and thought-provoking read. Published in hardback by Headline. So this really is a good month for police procedurals, or certainly ones that came to my attention anyway. Each of them very distinctive in their own way, and that's true of this one, as Tim Sullivan releases the sixth, D.S. George Cross thriller. This one, The Teacher. Cross is socially awkward but brilliant. He He sees cases in a totally different way to his colleagues. He takes the law literally and is unencumbered by prejudice or making judgments that don't fit the facts. Naturally, there's an interesting dynamic in the office with his colleagues and his friends, and he has a cipher in D.S. Otti who recognizes his strengths. Cross is a superb creation, a detective you can enjoy being with on and off the job. One of the other strengths of the series is the focus on the victims. In this case, 80-year-old Alistair Moreton. His fatal fall down the stairs of his 18th-century cottage begins to look more like murder as an eagle-eyed Bobby spots irregularities. As Cross and the Major Crimes Unit of Avon and Somerset investigate, witnesses say Moreton changed in recent weeks and he was hiding something in the house. Moreton was a retired teacher, not well-liked by locals or ex-pupils. He seems to have been an unpleasant and cruel man. Is someone paying him back for the actions of the past? And even if there were things that he should have answered for in his lifetime, doesn't every victim deserve justice? Screenwriter-director Sullivan has come up with a modern, relevant detective series and knows how to blend complex moral themes with page-turning excitement. I hope that we have plenty more of the George Cross series to come, published by Head of Zeus in hardback. If you love a twisty tale with a strong psychological edge, The Woman on the Ledge might satisfy. Ruth Mancini is a practicing lawyer as well as a crime writer, and that infuses the novel. It opens with a woman being arrested for murder, accused of killing another woman who fell from the building where she works. Though she pleads her innocence, Tate Kinsler is reluctant to tell her story. Yes, she knew the victim. They met at a party in her offices. Yes, they talked. But later, when the woman dies, she says she wasn't involved. And yet there appears to be evidence to the contrary. So what connects the two women? What is it that Tate is hiding? Is she guilty or is she being framed? In order to save her, her lawyer Sarah demands the whole story. Now there isn't much I can say without giving away spoilers. Let's just add that there are layers to the narrative. It all relies on a slow release of information, but it will have you rethinking what you think you know all the way through. A lot depends on the characters Tate and Sarah. If you like them, you'll be in for the whole ride. A novel of obsession and revenge, published in hardback by Century. And now over to Stephanie Sowden to tell us about her new book, Directions for Dark Things.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Sowden, and my second book, Directions for Dark Things, is published on the 25th of this month. Set in Hollywood in the 1980s, it tells the story of real estate broker Terry, who in a bid to solve her financial troubles, drives up to the eminent Lloyd House to persuade its owner to sell its vast land for development. But Audrey Lloyd, the heiress to her father's golden age movie dynasty, is notoriously difficult, a hermit who's refused to sell the land for decades. But when Terry arrives on her doorstep, she mysteriously agrees to sell under one condition. Terry must spend the week visiting her. Terry agrees and is drawn into Audrey's world, one where history and now are easily confused. With Terry's personal life unraveling at home, she finds herself getting more and more caught up in Audrey's web, but will she forget what she came for? A week later, and Detective Don Vernon is called to the house to investigate the body of a woman, an investigation which similarly blurs the lines between past and present, as he unpicks the clues for this death which began many years before. So if a dark tale that explores Hollywood's forgotten past and spooky old houses sound right up your street, check out Directions for Dark Things now.
Thank you, Stephanie. And that's published in paperback by Canelo Crime. C.S. Robertson is the pen name for Craig Robertson for his high-concept novels. The first in 2022 was The Undiscovered Deaths of Grace McGill, and that was one of the most intriguing reads of the year, original and poignant. Now we have The Trials of Marjorie Crow. Marjorie takes a walk around Kilgoyne at precisely 11:30 a.m. and 6:30 p.m. every day. You can set your watch by her progress through the village. The folk of Kilgoyne find her strange. Views vary from sad spinster to grisly old witch. Then one morning walk Marjorie is late, 11 minutes late. Something along the way detained her. She's clearly shaken, but says nothing to anybody. The body of Charles McKee is found in the woods that Marjorie passes shortly after that. When the police question her, she admits to seeing the hanged boy. Why is she so afraid? She seems to think the terrors of the past are being revisited on the village, hinting that many years ago an evil struck this place. Strangely, another witness claims to have seen Charlie alive sometime after Marjorie claims Charlie was dead. Is she lying? Did she kill the boy? The town turn against her. Marjorie will have to prove her own innocence. But to start with, that will certainly only get her in deeper. There's a depth to this story that makes it intriguing, and a mood that chills. Published in hardback by Hodder. The only one left by Riley Sager is a gothic thriller. Kit McDear is a carer who accepts a new job looking after Lenora Hope. The notorious Lenora is the only surviving member of her family following a massacre at their clifftop mansion on the Massachusetts coast near Boston, an event that occurred decades earlier. She's assumed to be the killer, think Lizzie Borden. Lenora is now an old lady. She's mute and confined to a wheelchair since a stroke, many years ago. Kit provides Lenora with a typewriter, and she claims to want to tell her story, the whole truth of that fateful night. So Kit will have to decide whether he can trust her version of events. There are strange things around this house. Why did Lenora's last carer leave suddenly? And what about Mrs. Baker, the mysterious housekeeper who's kept everything in order since that terrible night? One thing you can be sure of is nothing is as it seems. There are twists and turns aplenty in the present and the past, and they make for a complex mystery thriller. Sager writes modern gothic very well, and there's bags of atmosphere in this book. For readers who like to undo box puzzles, the slow release of information is crucial to the studied nature of the plot, but it's a lot of dark fun. Published by Hodder in paperback. The only in-translation title this month is The Lover of No Fixed Abode by Carlo Frutero and Franco Lucentini, translated by Gregory Dowling, and written and set in 1980s Venice. It's the first novel by the two authors translated into English. The novel opens on arrival in the city, and closes 3 days later with the exit from the city. And it's the story in particular of two people. An elegant Roman princess, an art dealer. She's scouting for undervalued paintings for a large English auction house. And the man she's destined to fall for is a tour guide. His erudition and bearing are at odds with his threadbare appearance. But this is Serenissima, the city of canals and art and architecture, and romance blossoms. 3 really intense days. One question haunts the narrative. Who is this man really? Against a backdrop of cosmopolitan parties, art deals, shady practices and fraud, we witness a love letter to the watery city, the labyrinth of the plot mirroring the intricacies of the city's alleys and canalways. This is a lightly told tale, entertaining in tone, riddled with reflections on art and life. And it's a satire on class and wealth. This is the 4th of 6 novels the authors wrote together before Lucentini's death in 2002. It's a slim mystery, revolving as much around the identity of the guide as art skullduggery. But it's elegantly written and translated. A magical, witty little read. Published by Bitter Lemon Press in paperback. 3 Little Birds is the latest from Irish author Sam Blake. Now, I've not read her before, but this book gripped me from the beginning. It's not always easy to explain, but sometimes you're in safe hands and you know it from the start. You know it's going to be a good experience, and that's the way I felt reading 3 Little Birds. Carla Steele works for the Anthropology and Computer Enhancement Department at Dublin Garda. DS Jack Maguire seeks her help when divers find a head in Loch Coyne in Mayo. A skull, it's been there some time. It's clear to Carla it's a young girl. It leads to the reopening of a 14-year-old case, the disappearance of Danielle Brennan. Carla then works with Maguire and criminal psychologist Grace Franicosi, and as a body turns up near the lake, it's no longer just a cold case. A really intriguing mystery with well-drawn characters and a gripping narrative, published by Corvus in hardback. Yeah, this also seems to be a month for high-concept novels. First Lie Wins is another one, written by Ashley Elston. And of course, one of the things about a high-concept novel is that the story has to live up to the premise, and Ashley Elston's First Lie Wins certainly does. Evie Porter and Ryan Sumner appear to be the perfect couple. Evie moves in with Ryan and quickly adapts to her new life and Ryan's friends. It appears an idyllic setup. Only the problem is, Evie doesn't actually exist. It's a false identity. This is her latest job, and it has to go right after the last debacle. Evie has meticulously researched the town and the people, and of course the mark, Ryan himself. Evie works for the mysterious Mr. Smith, a man she's never met face to face. And equally, Evie protects her own real identity. Only Smith knows who she is and where she came from, because one day she hopes to return to that life. The trouble starts when a woman walks into town bearing Evie's name. and telling stories that clearly say that she's living on Evie's identity. With so much at stake, one mistake could lose Evie everything. So how did Evie get here? What does the other woman want? What game is afoot and who's pulling the strings? To complicate matters, all the while Evie is actually falling for Ryan. There's plenty of twists and suspense in this thriller, soon to be made for TV. This really could gain traction with readers. It's easy to get immersed in Evie's world. Published in hardback by Headline. Another title from Headline, this time a debut, 27 Minutes by Ashley Tate. Also a potential hit. The novel opens with a tragic car crash. It's an evocative scene of a young woman dying, desperately, feverishly even, grasping at survival, thinking about her family. It's gripping, and the poignancy of the scene sinks in, as Phoebe dies. Grant was also involved in the accident. But the big question is, why did he wait for 27 minutes to call the ambulance? If he'd made that call earlier, Phoebe might have survived. West Wilmer is a small town, and even 10 years on, people remember the crash and still harbour doubts about Grant and his behaviour that night. We soon realise that the secrets behind the crash are eating away at Grant. But Becca was also involved in that crash. Unfortunately, her memory of what happened is hazy. What we do know is that that same fateful night, June's brother Wyatt disappeared, and now someone is suggesting they know what happened to him and where he is. June, of course, will want to pursue that. Needless to say, these things are connected, and it's stylishly done and atmospheric. It's skillfully plotted. Actually a clever debut. Published by Headline in hardback. And again, it appears to be a good month for Irish writers, as I also feature Where They Lie by journalist Claire Coughlan. Nicoletta works for the Irish Sentinel. It's a few days before Christmas in 1968. Her colleague Duffy mentions Gloria Fitzpatrick, the last woman sentenced to death in Ireland, in 1943. Her sentence was commuted, and she spent her life in an insane asylum before dying in 1959. They got her for the killing of Elizabeth Rourke, but she never admitted to harming Julia Bridges, the actress who went missing in Dublin in 43. Also believed to be a patient of Fitzpatrick. She went missing shortly before the former midwife and backstreet abortionist was arrested. When the bones of Julia Bridges turn up in a garden on the edge of Dublin, Nicoletta, the ambitious young reporter, investigates. Nicoletta is drawn into the world of illegal abortions in search of answers to a 25-year-old mystery. And what she finds is complex and personal and more than she could have ever imagined she'd have to face. It's a picture of one of the dark aspects of Irish history and gets that tragedy of the times, particularly for women. The story relies perhaps a little bit on coincidence, but has fantastic characters and an authentic feel. And so it's an intriguing read, published by Simon & Schuster in hardback. So last among the crime novels, a quick word for Just a Girl with a Gun by Maxim Jacobowski. It's a noir, a twisted love story, a journey of self-discovery. It's explicit but not gratuitous, and it's a great piece of storytelling. Cornelia is an exotic dancer and an assassin, a good one. Her life is largely empty of emotion. Her only love, rare books. Hopley is also an assassin. When they meet, neither realizes they work for the same organization, but the attraction is clear. Both have to reassess their lives. Hopley kills an innocent victim on a job, prompting a friend to hunt for the assassin. And misfortune leads that friend to Cornelia. The company, of course, don't like the attention, and Cornelia has to choose where her loyalties lie. It's a story that takes us from the sex clubs of Paris to the Latin Quarter of New Orleans to New York and misadventure at sea. The story has some beautiful subtleties. Jacobowski's love of place shines. Cornelia is an unforgettable creation, and there are shocking and poignant moments in the fast Faustian tale. The end is poetic, a meditation on the weight and absurdity of life. It's devastating. Published by Telos in paperback. And finally, my wildcard pick. A book I'm still digesting, one I think that will be with me for a long time. The Fatal Alliance by David Thompson, A Century of War on Film. Thompson is one of the great film critics. His work is about where film fits into society, how it shapes how we see ourselves, how art imitates life and vice versa. Like the best intelligent writing on a theme, it's a sumptuous and engrossing read. He has an easy style, but all the time he's drilling into the movies, he's filling out the bigger picture. It's a provocative survey covering the movies from the period after the First World War to the present. The big names are here, of course, All Quiet on the Western Front, Saving Private Ryan, Black Hawk Down, Apocalypse Now. And we get a sense of his love for film, but also an appreciation of the link between film and war. How theatregoers consume the great tragedy of war on screen.
Les Grands Guignols.
It's a survey that makes us consider what war films say about us. And it's a real joy to engage so fully with a book of ideas. A superb essay.
So do yourself a favour. Buy any of the crime books I've mentioned that you fancy. But certainly get this one too.
I think it's little short of a masterpiece. I love this book. HarperCollins, hardback.
And that's it for my selections. You can check out any of the titles on the programme notes and the release dates. A couple are still due to come out.
Thank you very much for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and subscribe with your favourite podcast provider. I'll be back with another interview very shortly. And of course, I'll be back with a review show next month. For now, bye, and thank you very much for listening.